You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
These extraordinary and dangerous acts of aggression, orchestrated by a foreign nation, have crossed a line.
Ask if they want their neighborhoods turned into a war zone by a wannabe dictator.
A lot of people are saying maybe we'd like a dictator.
It is time for this terrible conflict to end.
Welcome back to World News Weekly. I'm Claudia Farhart in Bangkok.
And I'm Ben Lewis in London.
We have a big episode coming up this week, why Australia is severing ties with Iran. Our chief political correspondent, Anna Henderson, will be talking us through that dramatic announcement from Canberra. Plus, global calls for accountability after Israel's double strike on a hospital in southern Gaza.
We're also going to be chatting about Donald Trump's latest threats to set troops on Democrat cities. Plus, the hard-right Reform Party here in the UK announces plans for a mass deportation of migrants if it wins the next election.
And stick around till the end if you'd like to hear all about what Ben's been doing when he's not playing Chief International Correspondent. And it has a lot to do with the K-pop Demon Hunters.
Oh, love them.
These were extraordinary and dangerous acts of aggression orchestrated by a foreign nation on Australian soil. They were attempts to undermine social cohesion and sow discord in our community.
That was Prime Minister Anthony Albanese speaking there, and we're starting off this week with a big story at home. Australia has all but severed diplomatic ties with Iran after the PM said the government has credible evidence Tehran was behind two arson attacks targeting the Jewish community last year. The Iranian ambassador was given 3 days to leave the country on Tuesday. It was the first time Canberra has expelled an ambassador since World War II.
That's right. All Australian diplomatic staff were withdrawn from Iran before the announcement, but Canberra says it will keep some diplomatic ties to Tehran open. So far, the government hasn't said what that credible evidence of Iran's involvement is, but ASIO's chief has said the attacks were directed by Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which the government is now moving to formally designate as a terror organisation. To talk us through it all, we're joined from Parliament House now by our chief political correspondent, Anna Henderson. Welcome back to the Pod Hendo.
Always a pleasure, and what a week to be on.
What a week indeed. Now, Iran is denying the allegations. Its foreign minister has called Anthony Albanese a weak politician and is accusing him of trying to appease Israel. What more do we know about the evidence ASIO has gathered on this?
I think we can say at this point that we still don't know a lot, and there's still a lot of hunger for more information. It's been a very careful construction of what has allegedly occurred in terms of that credible evidence that Iran's Revolutionary Guard, according to the domestic spy agency, used what they described as a layer cake, which was interesting terminology, of cutouts to essentially drip feed information through a range of intermediaries and then pay, in some cases, local organized crime gangs to carry this out. And what they believe is that these kind of low-level criminals who ended up being involved allegedly in these attacks didn't know who was asking them to do it. So there were various ways that this may have been undertaken. Some briefing notes that I've managed to sort of assemble throughout the course of the investigation would suggest to me that it's through encrypted apps that this may have well been funneled down with an attempt to really hide the real motivation of what was going on and which country was involved. But there has been in the last couple of months some suggestion in some of the reporting around this that there could have been a foreign country involved. But we only had that confirmation in that press conference on Tuesday that Iran had been named as the country directing this. And then that the way this is now going to unfold is there'll be criminal prosecutions through the Australian courts for these people who are alleged to have actually conducted these firebombings in Melbourne and Sydney. And through the criminal facts that we'll hear there, perhaps we'll get more of an insight into what's being alleged here internationally. But to take such extraordinary action, to expel an ambassador, something Australia hasn't done since the Second World War, does show the gravity that the government and the spy agencies and the federal police are treating this with, because I think what the government's tried to make clear is that this is not necessarily been a relationship of having diplomatic ties with Iran because they want to have a friendly relationship. They've wanted to have a presence in Tehran to ensure that if any Australians are caught up there, they can get consular assistance. And so by deciding to do this, they've cut off any line of direct assistance from Australia to, you know, there are more than 2,000 Australians in Iran right now, for example. So this is a huge step to leave all of those Australian citizens in a position where they don't have any access to local help from Australia in that country. I think it just goes to the gravity of the evidence that the spy agency says is before them.
And Anna, on the second point, Canberra now moving to list Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a terror organisation. What is that going to actually mean in practical terms? And why do you think we're seeing Canberra do this now?
There has been a lot of pressure to do this. There was actually a Senate committee 2 years ago that was recommending this. And, you know, the government held off. And, you know, SBS has asked the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister a number of times in the past why this listing hasn't happened, because we've had, you know, credible reports from the Iranian community in Australia of their experiencing foreign interference over a number of different issues unrelated to these firebombings over the years. So for a long time, there's been pressure to list the IRGC. It requires a change to the law, because at the moment you can't list a state actor under our existing legislation in this way. So there is support from the coalition to change the law so that they can list the IRGC as a terrorist organisation. It changes the kinds of offences you can charge people with in Australia. And it also sends a very strong and, for Australia, relatively unprecedented message that they're prepared to list an actual state or an arm of a state as a terrorist organisation, as opposed to, say, Hamas or Hezbollah, which aren't considered state actors. So there's a lot that's still unclear on this point, though, as well. It must be pointed out, because we haven't seen the legislation. The Home Affairs Minister, Tony Burke, says they're in the process of drafting it now. But exactly what the practical outcome will be, we're not yet clear on.
Hendo, thank you. We're going to keep you on the Canberra line because we'll check in with you a little bit later in the pod.
Looking forward to it.
While we're speaking about Iran, we have a couple updates on its nuclear program too this week. The UK, France and Germany are set to trigger the snapback mechanism from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal if Tehran doesn't return to the negotiating table. That means that the sweeping UN sanctions that were on Iran before the deal would be automatically reimposed in full without any Security Council members having a chance to veto them.
The snapback mechanism expires in October, exactly 10 years after the Iran nuclear deal came into effect, so this could be the European powers' last chance to use it. They're demanding three things from Tehran: that it restart negotiations with the US, allow UN inspectors back into its nuclear sites, and account for the more than 400 kilos of highly enriched uranium it was known to have stockpiled before the US and Israeli bombing campaign earlier this year.
Iran seems pretty unlikely to agree to any of those conditions. UN inspectors have just arrived back in the country for the first time since that US and Israeli bombing campaign targeting Iran's nuclear facilities we saw back in June. But there's now an Iranian ban on cooperating with them, so they likely won't be able to achieve much. As for the negotiations with the US, they were already reluctant to return to the table earlier in the year after Donald Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in his first term. And that was after 8 years. So it's kind of hard to see how they'd be willing to talk now, just a couple of months after that unprecedented bombing campaign. And the point on the highly enriched uranium was interesting, because back during the bombing campaign, Trump claimed that the US had completely obliterated Iran's nuclear program, including those stockpiles. But there were a lot of doubts at the time. There were theories that those stockpiles had been moved to a safer location before the strikes and may have survived. So now that these European powers are asking to see them, kind of suggests they don't believe those stockpiles were destroyed either. But given the US and Israel have both said they'd be willing to strike Iran again to prevent them from building a nuclear weapon, a lot of analysts believe that's the exact kind of ambiguity Tehran now wants around its nuclear program.
To Gaza now, and the UN is demanding accountability after a series of Israeli strikes on southern Gaza's largest hospital killed 20 people, including another five journalists. This happened on Monday morning. It started with one strike, which led first responders and reporters to rush to the scene. Then approximately 9 minutes later came a second strike, which was live-streamed online, and that appears to be the attack that led to the majority of the casualties. That evening, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it a tragic mishap that Israel deeply regrets. But the next day, the IDF said the attack was designed to destroy an observation camera placed in the area by Hamas to monitor Israeli forces. Israel is yet to offer evidence to support that.
Yeah, Ben, so they seem to be sort of two conflicting explanations there given by the Israeli PM and the IDF. And these attacks are now setting off another debate around the legality of how Israel is handling this war. Under international law, it's illegal to strike hospitals during war unless they're being used for acts harmful to the enemy. And throughout the course of the war, we have heard Israel accuse Hamas of operating from inside Gaza's medical facilities. That has often been the reason the IDF has given for previous strikes on them. But we're seeing two issues being raised here. The first is whether the presence of an observation camera would be enough to nullify those protections that hospitals have under international law, whether surveillance would be considered an act designed to harm the enemy. The second issue is why Israel struck the hospital twice. These attacks are often referred to as double taps. The first strike will draw first responders to the scene, so medics, journalists, only for them to become casualties in the second strike. So we're also hearing a lot of questions now over why that kind of strategy would be needed to take out a single camera.
Yeah, proportionality is a big question here. The IDF says it is investigating the incident. The Associated Press and the Reuters news agency, both of which lost staff in the attacks, are questioning whether that investigation will be transparent. In a joint statement, they said, "Unfortunately, we have found the IDF's willingness and ability to investigate itself in past incidents to rarely result in clarity and action." And just a note on what these journalists were doing. We, of course, cannot go into Gaza as international journalists. The only people working on the ground are people who live there. We rely on these live shots to be able to cover the story properly. And once again, the international media world, journalism community, is asking for access to Gaza. It's been blocked now for 22 months.
As you all know, Chicago's a killing field right now. And they don't acknowledge it. And they say, "We don't need him. Freedom, freedom. He's a dictator. He's a dictator." A lot of people are saying, maybe we like a dictator. I don't like a dictator. I'm not a dictator. I'm a man with great common sense, and I'm a smart person. And when I see what's happening to our cities, and then you send in troops, instead of being praised, they're saying, "You're trying to take over the republic." These people are sick.
Donald Trump there responding to critics, including the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, who have slammed his administration's use of the National Guard and seizure of the police force in Washington, D.C. The president is now threatening to expand the U.S. military presence to cities including Chicago and Baltimore. The problem mayors of this city will face is that legally there's not much they can do if the White House decides to deploy those forces.
It sort of feels to me like Donald Trump here is pushing the limits of his power, testing them. The idea of sending troops into an American city like he did in LA during the riots and now in DC would once have caused outrage. Like imagine if Barack Obama had sent the National Guard into Dallas, for example. But the president thinks that doing this in order to tackle something most voters don't like, which is crime in this case, means he can probably get away with it. People might have problems with seeing troops on city streets, but if they're told it means those streets are safer, some people might think the ends justify the means. And some are going as far to suggest this is a strategy to normalise it so that if he ever needs to, President Trump can deploy troops for his own needs, for example, in order to retain power. It might seem like a pretty out there idea, but incredibly one that is being mooted. Of course, there's the question too as to if any of this is actually necessary. In DC, for example, violent crime was already well down on last year, and some of those National Guard troops have just been standing around with nothing to do. There's video of them picking up rubbish, for example. And you'll notice the cities that President Trump is talking about are all run by Democrat mayors in blue states, so expect that this will all reach a crescendo before the midterm elections next November. And there are other moves the Trump administration is making too. The Transportation Department has announced plans to take control of running DC's Union Station. It's the sort of thing Republicans would have railed against, that was a very deliberate pun, in years past.
And Ben, we know Donald Trump has desires on taking over Greenland. He hasn't been all that subtle about those. But Denmark says his administration has now gone too far. What's all that about?
Yeah, this all seems to be part of a quite inept spy mission. So Greenland is an autonomous part of the Kingdom of Denmark, and Denmark wants it to stay that way. But if you ask Greenlanders, a majority want independence. Very few want to be part of the United States. However, Donald Trump is still keen on taking the strategically important territory and might be trying to do that through what's been described as an influence campaign. Denmark's public broadcaster, DR, says American citizens with personal relationships to the Trump administration have been conducting covert operations in Greenland, looking to compile a list of Greenlanders who would back a US attempt to take over the territory. It's probably a pretty short list. Denmark's foreign minister says any attempt to interfere in his country's internal affairs is unacceptable. The top US diplomat in Copenhagen has been summoned, which in diplomatic circles means he's going to get a dressing down. And while all of this may seem a little ridiculous and a pretty amateur hour operation by these Americans, it is one NATO ally actively working to annex another's territory.
Yeah, pretty extraordinary. And finally, in the US this week, Australia's Defence Minister Richard Marles has been in Washington for meetings with Vice President JD Vance and Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth. If you read the press release from Minister Marles' office, there's lots of talk about deepening partnerships, the Indo-Pacific and so on. But this is largely about AUKUS, the security pact between Australia, the US and the UK. The Pentagon announced that it would conduct a review of the agreement that would see Australia receive nuclear-powered submarines. That's now been expanded to an administration-wide review.
And astonishingly, his US defence counterpart, Pete Hegseth, has described the meeting as a, quote, happenstance encounter. We've still got Anna Henderson with us in Canberra. Anna, this seems a little embarrassing. Is it a sign of the times, how the Trump administration does business? Or is it a particular issue with US-Australia relations?
And that is the really big question here, because there was that early statement about, you know, this being happenstance. We still don't really know why the Defence Minister and Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles actually took this unexpected trip to Washington at the last minute. We assumed that it would involve a meeting with Pete Hegseth, the Defence Secretary, because it was on the briefing notes that we were provided. Then the meeting was unclear. There was a scheduling clash. A press conference that Richard Marles was supposed to conduct in Washington didn't materialise either. And we had that early suggestion of happenstance from the Pentagon. Well, actually, it was quite a clear statement that it was not a meeting. They just happened to, you know, have a quick bump in and a photo opportunity. And then later today, we've had a fresh statement from the Pentagon from its chief spokesman, Sean Parnell. That statement says, Secretary Hegseth welcomed the opportunity to meet in person with the Deputy Prime Minister. Their meeting at the White House was coordinated in advance. So it does seem like there's perhaps a little chaos in the Pentagon about how they're responding to inquiries, I would suggest. But it's an awkward moment for Richard Marles and for the Prime Minister, because so many questions remain about what is the blockage that is meaning that the Prime Minister is yet to have another phone conversation with Donald Trump since the one that he had when he won back power. There's just been this vacuum of time. But the other thing I think it's good to point out is that Richard Marles did also meet with the Vice President, JD Vance, while he was in Washington. We don't know the detail of what they discussed either, but that could be the more important meeting and perhaps the reason he went. Because we're in the lead up to the September UN General Assembly meetings in New York. This is the time when Anthony Albanese and Donald Trump will be in the same place. Perhaps that is the more important engagement to kind of set a framework for Australia and the US government to have like a leader level engagement. So it just feeds into this questioning around whether or not the government actually is having a pretty significant breakdown in high level relations with the US at the moment. And now in question time, we just saw play out some of those tensions and criticisms from the opposition in front of a US congressman.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us on the pod again this week. We'll let you go for real this time. That was our chief political correspondent, Anna Henderson.
The mood in the country around this issue is a mix between total despair and rising anger. And I would say this, that without action, without somehow the contract between the government and the people being renewed, without some trust coming back, then I fear deeply that that anger will grow. In fact, I think there is now, as a result of this, a genuine threat to public order.
That's Mr. Brexit himself, now Reform UK leader Nigel Farage, talking about the anger in Britain regarding asylum seekers being housed in hotels across the country. There's been demonstrations held outside these hotels in recent weeks, and some have seen clashes with counter-protesters. It follows a series of incidents in which migrants were arrested for attacks on women. Mr. Farage's populist Reform UK party, which polls suggest holds a sizable lead over the Labour government, has announced plans for mass deportations if it is elected at the next vote, not due until 2029.
Yeah, this is pretty extraordinary. Reform's key policy is to deport as many as 600,000 migrants. That is an enormous number, and if you think about it, it would be an almost unprecedented logistical operation. The plan is to change Britain's laws so that anyone who arrives in the UK via a small boat across the English Channel will never be able to claim asylum here. Migrants would be detained at disused military bases rather than in hotels, and would be offered around $5,000 to return home voluntarily. If they refuse, they'll be deported. What's not clear is how you would get countries to take these people back. Would Iran and Syria, for example, really want to take people who've tried to flee? Now, Afghanistan, ruled by the Taliban now, has already said, yep, we're up for a deal. Rwanda has said they'd be happy to take some people as well. Under a previous Conservative government scheme, they received hundreds of millions of dollars to take in migrants. None were actually sent. Then there's the question about people who are in genuine need of asylum. Some could face imprisonment, torture, or worse if sent back. Asked about this, Nigel Farage simply said the UK can't solve all the world's problems. This is all pretty legally tricky too, as it would probably require the UK to leave the European Court of Human Rights, joining Russia and Belarus as the only countries in Europe who aren't signed up. And that could put the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland in jeopardy.
So, Ben, what's been happening over there in London? What's the British government's response to all of this been?
Yeah, Labour here knows that this is a big issue. Even though only a third of those who claimed asylum in the UK last year arrived by small boat, it's a very visual problem. You see those images of mostly young men crowded into dinghies arriving on the coast of Britain. They have a big impact on voters here. And Keir Starmer was elected promising to, quote, smash the gangs, the people smugglers who profit from the trade. And he's also done a deal with France for a pilot scheme where for every migrant Britain sends back across the Channel, it will take in a genuine asylum seeker. So Labour is essentially joining in the tough rhetoric, not going as far as Reform, though. But it is discovering, as the Tories did over the previous 14 years, that this is a really hard problem to solve. It's not like Australia. The English Channel is only a few miles wide at its narrowest point, and there's a huge amount of coastline to police. If he was elected Prime Minister, Nigel Farage would probably discover the same thing. Ironically, it was much easier for the UK to return migrants to the European mainland when it was part of the European Union. And of course, who was the loudest campaigner for Brexit? Nigel Farage. He said that Brexit would allow Britain to protect its borders from migrants. It seems the opposite has been the case.
That one may be backfiring on Mr. Brexit. time for a quick spin around the world now. And let's start off in Ukraine, where Kyiv has admitted Russian forces have entered the Dnipro region. It's the first time they've tried to establish a foothold in the central Ukrainian oblast. Ukraine's military says the advance has been stopped, and it's more of a symbolic action rather than anything that will have broader strategic consequences. Russia's summer offensive appears to be coming to an end, having only made minor gains in the Donetsk region. Ukraine says it is now taking back some villages that had been occupied, but Russian forces continue to press across the Donbas, testing the Ukrainian defensive lines.
To Venezuela now, where retirees, civil servants, stay-at-home mums and others have been volunteering to join the country's militia, amid concern about a US invasion. President Nicolas Maduro has urged citizens to sign up to the civilian corps after what he called outlandish threats from the White House. The United States has stationed three warships off the Venezuelan coast for what have been described as anti-drug operations. Maduro claims there are more than 4.5 million soldiers in the militia ready to fight, but independent studies suggest the real number is around 340,000. Washington has issued a $50 million bounty for the Venezuelan president, who the Trump administration accuses of leading a drug cartel.
And to Pakistan, where the government has evacuated more than 150,000 people and issued major flood warnings after India opened the floodgates on two major dams. The region is being battered with heavy monsoon rains. Flash floods and landslides have already killed more than 30 people in Indian-administered Kashmir this week. Indian officials warned Pakistan it was preparing to release water from the dams earlier this week in what was the first known diplomatic contact between the two countries since they traded fire for 4 days along the line of control in Kashmir back in May.
The world will know you as pop stars. But you will be much more than that.
Those are the sweet sounds of the K-pop Demon Hunters. Now, don't feel bad if you don't know what that means. I didn't until I was asked to write this 24 hours ago. But K-pop Demon Hunters is an animated film about teenagers in a K-pop singing group who secretly battle the forces of evil, and it has become Netflix's most watched movie in its history.
Yes, it has had more than 236 million views. And just a reminder to our listeners that Ben did write this part. I'm apparently responsible for at least a dozen of them. Well played,
Ben. Love it.
The sing-along version has also broken records at cinema box offices, and songs from the soundtrack have topped music charts across the world. It has also been popular with many critics, not just with Ben, who have praised its depiction of both traditional and modern Korean culture, although some viewers have argued the portrayal of Korean customs and traditions is a little superficial and sanitized for Western audiences.
Still, it seems to have struck a chord with viewers, although it hasn't hit the critical 40-year-old man in London demographic. But given its success, expect to see a flood of K-pop-related content coming to your screens in the coming years.
We did actually have one listener write in last week, Ben, and ask to see a video of you performing one of these songs. So we'll get back to you.
I'm still in my Gangnam Style era, so I haven't learnt the dances yet, but I'll get on that.
And that is all we have time for on this week's edition of World News Weekly. Don't forget to subscribe to get a new episode each week.
And if you're into your global news, why not do something old-fashioned and watch SBS World News on the TV or our condensed headlines-only version on YouTube every evening Australian time. Catch you next time.